like a bad actor in a soap opera. What a surprise! Virginia! Mrs. Lorette took a tissue out of her sleeve and sniffed into it. This is my daughter, Ruby, who I've been telling all about you. She turned to Mr. Lorette. I understand you've been unwell.
Right. I have.
She could have sworn he hunched over slightly, as if exaggerating his frailty. Mrs. Lorette put her arm through his, and they exchanged nervous glances. Well, we brought you some soup. She held it out, and Mrs. Lorette took the bag but made no move to return to the house. Thank you. I know you've been going through a lot lately, and I figured I'd get that name and number from you and take over the investigation again, so you don't have to be bothered.
Name and number?
Mr. Lorette looked at his wife, confused. Or was he faking it? The art expert, dear, for that watercolor from the art school. She smiled at Virginia, but it didn't reach her eyes. We should have some news by now, I would think. Virginia took out a pad of paper and a pencil from her handbag. What was that name again? Mrs. Lorette threw Virginia a sharp look. I'm getting the distinct impression you don't trust us. First off, let me tell you a little about how the art world works. Very slowly. You want something done correctly, you give it to an expert, and you wait. For a moment, Mrs. Lorette's withering reply left her chastised. She glanced over at Ruby, who gave an imperceptible shake of her head. Virginia wasn't imagining things. The woman's defensiveness was uncalled for. Suspicious. We'd like the phone number as well, please. Mr. Lorette regarded them both.
How dare you speak to us like that? We try to help you, and you turn on us. Not very kind, I must say.
Neither Virginia nor Ruby spoke. The silence dragged on.
Fine. Samson Couton. Works at the MoMA. I don't know the number offhand, but I'm sure the switchboard will connect you. If you ask politely.
Virginia's mind whipsawed with uncertainty. What if Mr. Lorette was right, that these things just took time, and she'd alienated the two people who had offered to help her? But she hadn't done anything but offer to assist them with the painting she'd discovered in the first place, and her heart raced at the thought of the painting being lost to her forever, after she'd only just rescued it from its hiding place. Virginia and Ruby hightailed it out of there. In the subway, on the way home, Virginia leaned into her daughter. They seemed so nice when I first met them. But after how they acted when I was trying to help, I think I'm being played. I got the same vibe. How much did the curator say the watercolor might be worth? $150,000? Ruby whistled. That's a ton of money. This probably sounds strange, but the painting means more to me than that. What if I never get it back? This Mr. Couton has no idea who I am. We've never spoken on the phone or met. I guess I'll dash over there during my lunch hour and hope for the best. Don't give up hope just yet, offered Ruby. Monday's my day off. If you like, I'll go to the MoMA first thing and track down the mysterious Mr. Couton. No doubt her daughter would have a better chance of getting through to him. He'd smell the desperation on Virginia right off, especially if she was in a rush. Would you? I'd be happy to be your partner in crime. Later that evening, Virginia stood in the corner of one of the Carlyles' private meeting rooms, where tasteful striped curtains and matching valances added a dash of color in a sea of creams and light browns. Ruby held court in the center of the room, where she belonged, flanked by two classmates from the Institute of Photography, the three of them giggling with delight. Finn and Xavier had outdone themselves, even convincing the manager of the hotel to throw in some champagne and a cheese platter for the exhibition of Ruby's Grand Central photos, which stood on simple wood easels arranged in a horseshoe pattern around the room. The two men were obviously in their element, surrounded by fabulous New Yorkers wearing leopard print and leisure suits, and Virginia was more than happy to take a back seat and watch the circus from afar. Finn glided over, offering to refill Virginia's champagne glass. "The party's a big hit." "How did you attract so many people? You don't even live here." "Bamelman's Bar, baby. I mentioned the exhibit the past week during my show, and of course people jumped to do my bidding." "Why am I not surprised?" "Where are all your co-workers? I imagine they would have loved this." Virginia had considered inviting the other information booth clerks, especially with the lovely photo of Doris that was part of the show, but in the end she had decided against it. "I was worried about inviting them. This place is so fancy, then they'd think I was fancy, and that I was somehow treating my job and the people who worked at Grand Central as objects." She shook her head. "I'm not making much sense. But I didn't want them to think I was using them." He clutched her arm. "Oh my God! Look! Over there!" A thin woman with dark chestnut hair stood with a couple of other ladies, studying the photo of the water fountain. She wore a biscuit-colored Chanel suit that fit in perfectly with the surroundings. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Virginia had been besotted with Jackie O since she'd stepped into the political spotlight. Jackie was 5 years older, practically her contemporary, but maneuvered through the world with a grace and charm that had always eluded Virginia. And now here she was in the same room as Virginia. "I can't believe it. What is she doing here?" Virginia couldn't help staring, even though everyone in the room was doing likewise, with varying degrees of subtlety. "I have no idea. Come on, let's go say hello."
"I couldn't."
"Why not?"
"I wouldn't know what to say."
She held Finn back.
"Look, she's approaching Ruby."
They shook hands, and Virginia swore Ruby did a small curtsy.
"That's my girl."
Virginia gathered up the courage to approach, and together she and Finn walked over, arm in arm, like a bride and groom on their wedding day. They were only a few feet away when another woman swooped in and whispered something in Jackie's ear. In an instant, Jackie and her two cohorts dashed out of the room and were gone.
"What? Where did they go?" asked Virginia.
The other woman, an elegant lady in pearls, overheard and turned to her. "Sorry about this. Apparently there's a scrum of photographers staked out in the lobby. We had to get her out the back door fast." She held out her hand. "My name is Adelaide Parsons, and I work at the Municipal Arts Society." Virginia recognized the organization, an urban planning and preservation group, from her committee days. She shook hands and introduced Finn and Ruby.
"My daughter is the photographer."
"Indeed. Your photos are glorious."
"It was all my mom's idea."
Ruby slung an arm around Virginia.
"She works in the terminal."
"You make a good team. It's a wonderful exhibition." Virginia beamed with motherly pride.
"We're hoping it might help raise awareness."
"I wish it were so. We've been fighting Penn Central on this since the late 1960s. Unfortunately, I don't believe there's much chance we'll win the court case at this point, but thank you for trying."
"You don't think they'll uphold the landmark status?" asked Virginia.
"Not the way things are going. The judge isn't very sympathetic to our cause. If he rules against us, Penn Central will be allowed to build on top of the terminal or demolish it entirely." She gestured toward the easels before letting her hand fall limply to her side. "At the very least, we'll have a lovely record of the past." Chapter 18. January 1975. The clerks buzzed with news at the information booth Monday morning.
Did you hear? Winston asked Virginia. Penn Central won their court case. I heard them talking about it in the station master's office. The judge declared that Grand Central isn't a landmark, so they can tear it down or do whatever they want.
Coming so soon after the success of Ruby's exhibition, the news was especially crushing. Virginia wondered about Dennis's reaction. He must be pleased. His colleagues were probably popping the champagne right about now. But Virginia's fellow employees looked worried. Toto dug his hands into his pockets, ignoring the man gesturing outside his window, and Doris looked like she was about to cry.
"What will happen to all of us?"
asked Winston.
Terence shook his head.
"It'll be the perfect opportunity to lay us off and replace us with younger folk. We'll have to find new jobs."
The unemployment rate was nearly 11%. Inflation was close to 12. None of the information booth clerks were good for anything other than answering transportation-related questions, and they should be looking forward to retirement, not the unemployment line.
"I'll go find out what's going on in the station master's office," said Terence. "Virginia, cover my window."
2 months ago, the request would have struck fear into her heart. But by now, she knew the answers to the most asked questions, and the few she didn't, she nudged Toto next to her and asked him. He threw her a glassy stare every time, but she didn't care. Ruby appeared at the window.
"Mom, can you get away?
Give me 5 minutes." As soon as Terence returned, shaking his head and looking even more depressed than when he'd left, Virginia took a break and met Ruby on the west balcony.
"How did it go?"
"Samson Couton doesn't exist. There's no one there by that name. The Lorettes have been lying the whole time."
Stunned, Virginia leaned over the railing, staring down at the swirls of people below.
"I was so stupid."
Ruby touched her shoulder.
"You had no idea they were crooks. You couldn't have known. You're not stupid. I just saw you answer 80 questions about this place in 5 minutes. You were amazing."
"You were watching me?"
Embarrassed, she straightened up and brushed off her sleeves.
"Yes. You were great, especially with the people who were rude.
I guess you get used to it."
But her daughter's compliments didn't make her feel any better.
"I got a degree in art history, and now I answer questions about departure times."
"And your daughter's a barmaid, as Dad keeps on reminding me."
While the recent blast of honesty with her daughter had been refreshing, Virginia was liable to bring her daughter right down with her if she wasn't careful. That was the last thing she wanted.
"Listen, don't let Dad pick on you. You're working, and there are very few jobs to be had in the city right now. Ignore him. But at the same time, remember that he has a good heart. He loves you, even if he's sometimes caught up in that fancy world of his. We're not like that, and that's fine."
Ruby nodded.
"What do we do now? We can't give up. Let's go back down there and confront the Lorettes again, or go to the police and tell them that they lied to us and stole it."
Virginia hated to let Ruby down, or lose this new connection with her daughter. She considered calling Janice at the Art Students League and ratting out the Lorettes, but if Janice telephoned them, they'd tell her that Virginia had taken it from the art school, had lied about finding it at her aunt's house, which made her look as shifty as the Lorettes.
"I highly doubt the Lorettes would answer the door or talk to us on the phone, now that they know we know they lied.
As for going to the police, we have no proof that we owned it in the first place."
"I have an idea," Ruby brightened. "Why don't you talk to Dad? He's a lawyer."
"You want me to ask your dad for legal advice?"
"Why not?
That painting is yours, right? The Lorettes took it from you.
I have no proof of that.
Still, meet up with him. Ask him for help.
Virginia studied Ruby, whose eyes were full of hope. I can't do that. I'm sorry. That's all over with.
Confiding in Chester would only make things worse.
He'd laugh at her, dismiss it as a wild goose chase.
She hoped Ruby understood the meaning behind her words, that their intact, happy family was over with as well.
You can't even ask him for advice?
No.
Ruby slumped over.
That's too bad. I'm glad you were here to help. Not that I did any good.
She pushed a lock of hair behind her daughter's ear.
You did. Thank you.
Virginia stopped by the apartment to collect the mail before going back to the Carlisle. Another threatening note. No surprise at that. She carried her mace in the side pocket of her purse now, just in case. Also in her mailbox was an official-looking letter from some law firm. She read it and gasped out loud, drawing a scowl from the doorman. Her upstairs neighbor had retained a lawyer who was threatening to sue Virginia for damages to their apartment. She had never met the upstairs neighbors, just heard them clomp back and forth across her ceiling every so often. But these people, the clompers, claimed that all their clothes, draperies, rugs, and furnishings had been damaged by smoke and had to be professionally cleaned. The bill was in the thousands.
She'd never be able to come up with that much money. Heck, she didn't even have enough to hire an attorney to question their claims.
The only answer was the one that her daughter most wished for. There was only one person left to ask for help.
You're tan.
Chester took off his coat, laid it carefully on the back of his chair, and sat down opposite Virginia in the oyster bar. I was in Mexico.
How strange to be strangers.
Virginia stared at him while he went through the motions of folding his napkin on the table, crooking up one finger to the waiter to ask for coffee, all the while avoiding eye contact. He'd lost weight, looked healthier than he had in ages. Before, she'd known what he was going to say before he even said it. She often finished his sentences, eager to show how close they were, how in tune she was. On the same wavelength, they called it these days. But now he was impenetrable. They both ordered the oyster stew. She reminded herself why she was there and spent the next 10 minutes inquiring about his work, their mutual acquaintances, ever so gently softening him up. For those 10 minutes, it was as if nothing had happened between them. They made fun of Betsy and her husband, worried together over a recently widowed colleague of Chester's. When he brought up Ruby's stint as a barmaid, she made light of it and changed the subject fast. He never once asked Virginia about her life. Just like old times. The oyster stews came. Nerves made her unable to eat more than a few bites, but she stirred the lumps around while chewing on the oyster crackers, which had made up most of her early pregnancy diet. Then Chester had been a true partner. She'd wisecrack about her morning sickness, using the language of a trucker because he loved it when she played up her working-class background. In private, of course. Never around his family or their friends. Her pregnancy and his attention had made her feel important, strong, able to bear anything. With her operation, it had been the opposite effect. She'd joke, hoping to get a smile out of him, and he'd cringe. A baby was one thing, a breast quite another. When the conversation lulled, Virginia scrambled for something else to talk about. She wasn't ready to ask for his help. Not yet.
Did you hear about the Grand Central ruling?
The words sounded odd coming out of her mouth, like she was trying too hard to impress.
I did.
The people I work with are worried that they'll lose their jobs when they build the new skyscraper. In fact, Doris spent the lulls in the day reading the Help Wanted ads out loud, until Winston told her to quit it.
They may lose their jobs, but in the end, it's all about progress. This city's a pit, and we need to remake it into something better. You can't live in the past.
His opposition didn't surprise her. I read that the city will probably appeal the ruling.
Don't believe everything you read.
Why wouldn't they?
He leaned back in his chair. It costs money to appeal, and the city is barely squeaking by as it is. If the city appeals and loses, then Penn Central could countersue for damages. Mayor Beam would be an idiot if he exposed the city to that kind of financial risk.
She glanced around. The judge called it a long-neglected faded beauty.
Faded beauty is putting it mildly. It's a dump.
Virginia didn't answer. She was a faded beauty herself. The thought stung. Back when she was sick, her doctors had told her that if they found cancer and didn't remove her entire breast, her prognosis would be poor, her disease terminal. Just like the building above her, from the Gustavino tiles of the Oyster Bar to the triumphal arch windows of the main concourse. She'd survived, but the terminal would not.
What did you want to meet about?
Chester had finished his stew and was eyeing hers. She pushed the bowl over to him. She pulled out the letter from her neighbor's attorney and handed it over to him. I'm being sued by my neighbor. They say they have $2,000 worth of damage from the fire.
If they had to get everything professionally cleaned, it adds up. Furniture, clothes, repainting the walls.
Not the answer she was hoping for. I can barely afford to fix my place, with the high deductible on my insurance policy. I was hoping I could get a loan from you.
Chester shook his head. I wish I could help, but I can't. I'm sorry. We're all strapped these days.
Not too strapped to go to Mexico.
It was a business trip, not a personal one. On top of that, the law firm is in financial trouble. We're hoping we can ride out the slump.
A momentary flicker of humiliation crossed Chester's face. He wasn't lying. She was embarrassed to ask him for money, and he was embarrassed to have to admit he didn't have it. I understand. Thank you for considering it.
There was only one other option.
There's this painting that I found, and I think it's worth a lot. I wanted to get your advice on that as well.
Shoot.
It's an early version of a painting that's up for auction in April by this artist named Levon Zakarian, who died tragically. They don't really know if he's the true artist because he signed it as Clyde and died before revealing himself, but everyone assumes it's his. She explained about the Chicago show and the train crash. This early version I found has a sketch on the backside that's by a woman illustrator. I think Clyde is this woman, not Levon Zakarian. If that's so, it would blow the minds of the art world people.
Chester perked up. Have you had it examined?
That's the thing. I seem to have hit a speed bump. You see, I gave it to an older couple who ran an art school back then, and they were going to get it examined or analyzed or some such thing, but they took off with it and won't return it.
What do you mean, they won't return it?
Just that. They won't give it back. Even worse, the expert they said they sent it to doesn't exist. They've been lying the whole time.
Do you have some kind of bill of sale for your sketch, or whatever it is?
No. I found it, you see, up in the old art school on the top floor of Grand Central. He wiped his mouth with his napkin and motioned to the waitress for the check.
If you don't have proof that it's yours, I don't see what you can do.
I was hoping you could help me somehow.
She didn't have much time. Chester's mind was elsewhere, mulling over his next appointment, figuring out how long it would take to get there, probably relieved to have lunch over with. I read in the paper a few months ago about the lawyer in your firm who recovered art taken in World War II by the Nazis. Maybe he could help prove that Clara Darden was the artist.
It's much more complicated than that, Virginia. You have no idea what you're talking about.
At least you could send a mean letter. You know how good you are at those. And then they'd realize I was serious and return it. He pulled a $10 bill out of his wallet. She continued, "It could be worth a lot of money. One curator told me that it might be worth over $150,000.
He looked up at that.
"Huh. Ruby and I have been working together on this, and we both thought maybe a mean letter from you would help. Her last chance, bringing up their daughter."
First of all, stop calling it a mean letter.
In the past, he'd laughed whenever she mangled legal language on purpose. Not anymore, apparently.
And it doesn't change my answer because you brought up Ruby.
The painting means something to me. It's important.
Lesson number one in negotiating. Don't get emotional.
How can I not get emotional? I'm going to be in serious legal trouble with these neighbors. Chester rubbed his eye with the meat of his palm, his habit whenever he grew annoyed.
You should have read the fine print in your insurance policy. Then none of this would be such a surprise.
He spoke to her as if she were a recalcitrant client, not the mother of his child. Tears pricked her eyes. She blinked, trying to stop them. I agree. It's been a sharp learning curve for me after the divorce. I didn't handle the finances when we were married, and so I made some mistakes early on.
We're no longer together, Virginia. You have to accept that and move on. I can't take care of you anymore.
He was right, of course. For the first time all lunch, Chester looked at her. Really looked at her. His eyes moved down her neck. Normally, she'd cover herself, but this time she didn't.
He nodded to her chest, his face unreadable. You've got a problem there.
She glanced down. Her mastectomy bra had ridden up, making her look lopsided, disfigured. She jumped up, grabbed her purse, and headed to the women's bathroom. Once there, she locked herself in a stall and let the tears come, bawling without making a sound. When she could cry no more, she unbuttoned her shirt and adjusted the bra, cursing her bad luck, her ex-husband, and the world. When Virginia finally emerged from the bathroom, the energy in the restaurant had shifted, the same way the air thickens imperceptibly before a thunderstorm. Gone were the last of the commuters and tourists. All the tables sat empty. Yet 50 or so men in suits and a few women milled about in groups, murmuring in low voices. At least Chester was gone. Her humiliation complete, she wound her way through the crowd, keeping her arm pressed tightly against her chest like a coat of armor. An excited buzz went through the crowd. Curious, Virginia lingered behind them, wondering what was going to happen next. Five or six tables had been pushed close together in a long row. On the middle table, a bouquet of microphones had been set up, the wires dangling down and along the floor like steel serpents. Virginia was in no hurry to return to the information booth. What did it matter if she did a good job or not, when it was all going to be over soon anyway? And the longer she took, the more time her red, swollen eyes would have to return to normal.
"Mr. Mayor! Mr. Mayor!"
the crowd called out as a group of seven walked through the front entrance and took up seats behind the long table. She recognized Mayor Beam right away, his thick, dark eyebrows a sharp contrast to his snow-white hair. The reporters waited as the rest of the mayor's entourage settled in their seats.
She couldn't get a good view, but his words cut clearly through the crowd as he introduced the Committee to Save Grand Central. Architect Philip Johnson, author Louis Auchincloss, and other names she didn't recognize, until he got to the last one.
Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis.
Virginia pushed her way forward, taking advantage of her small size to work her way up to the front row. The mayor introduced the group and praised the Municipal Art Society, which he said had spearheaded the effort to save Grand Central. Virginia spotted Adelaide, the woman from Ruby's exhibit, standing off to one side. The mayor continued.
We're fighting to save not only the terminal, but the very existence of our landmark law. If we don't stand up now, nothing can be saved.
The reporters scribbled down his words.
They reshuffled places so that Jackie sat in front of the microphone.
She wore a tan-fitted dress that draped her lithe body beautifully. A long gold chain hung from her neck, and matching earrings glittered against the black sheen of her hair. The crowd leaned in as she began to speak, her voice breathy.
We've all heard that it's too late, that it has to happen, that it's inevitable. But I don't think that's true. Because I think if there is great effort, even if it's at the 11th hour, you can succeed. And I know that's what we'll do.
Virginia couldn't wait to tell Ruby. She had no doubt her daughter's photographs had played a part in convincing the Municipal Art Society to put up a fight.
Isn't it inevitable for the terminal to come down if it can't support itself economically?
Shouted a reporter. Congressman Koch, a tall, balding man with a sardonic smile, cut in.
Central Park doesn't support itself. God forbid we should ever think of it in that way. Europe has its cathedrals, and we have Grand Central Station, added Philip Johnson.
Terminal, Virginia corrected him in her head. Terence would be very upset. Still, the sentiment was lovely. Just outside the doorway, she spotted Dennis standing close to another man. They both wore dark suits and carried briefcases. A fellow lawyer, probably, out spying on the opposition. As the press conference wrapped up, the mayor hightailed it out and the reporters surged after him, sweeping Virginia along. She found an eddy of calm in the passageway just outside the oyster bar and waited there, fishing in her pocketbook for a tissue, biding time until the crowds thinned.
Ignore it, Jack. They're posturing. The story will die down in a week.
Dennis was right behind her. She twirled around, a fake smile plastered on her face. But he was nowhere to be seen. Through the crush of the press corps, she spied Dennis and his buddy huddled 40 feet away in the opposite corner, speaking quietly. Of course, they were in the whispering gallery, where sound was telegraphed up and over the surface of the vault. She turned her head to locate the sweet spot where she could hear the voices clearly while still keeping an eye on the two men.
We sure don't need this aggravation, though, continued Dennis. You sure we're all set? The judge will listen to numbers, not rabble-rousers. The numbers are in our favor.
The man took a yellow file from the side pocket of his briefcase.
Here's the original balance sheet for Penn Central. The revised one, which will include the railway operating costs, should be ready in a few days.
Let's hope that does the trick.
We prove economic hardship. The judge will understand what a millstone this place is around Penn Central's neck. Trust me. By adding in those expenses, Grand Central looks like a sinking ship.
He put one hand up to shield his mouth from any observers, which only served to increase the clarity.
Creative accounting at its best. By my revised calculations, Penn Central lost $2 million just this year.
Dennis tucked the yellow folder into his briefcase.
Good work. Landmark my ass.
They disappeared up the ramp, clapping each other on the back. Virginia waited a few minutes before following. In the middle of the concourse, her information booth shone like an opal in a coal mine. Imagine if they fixed up the entire place, rubbed clean every marble surface like she had done. It would be magnificent. Like when it was first built, before hordes of people had spat on the stairways and scratched up the waiting room benches, back when it was still a gleaming work of art. She imagined a giant wrecking ball flying through the half-moon windows on the south facade, the shattered glass falling to the ground. The next blow would take out the thick stone slabs that had been painstakingly stacked on top of one another just after the turn of the century. The clock at the very top, where a statue of Mercury presided over Park Avenue South. Would that be saved? Probably not. Nor the melon-shaped chandeliers. All smashed to pieces. The next building would stand upon the powdered remnants, as Dennis had cavalierly declared, the way the ancients built a new city on the landfill of the old. In a few hundred years, archaeologists might come upon the golden acorn on the top of the information booth. They'd place it in a museum and mourn the past. She'd lost the opportunity to give Clara Darden the recognition she deserved, but the terminal was still standing. And maybe, unlike with the Clyde painting, Virginia could do something to save it. Chapter 19. October 1930.
Take a load off. With this rain, no one's coming in anytime soon.
Clara nodded to her boss, a former anarchist with the heart of a dove named Romany Marie, untied her apron and settled into a booth at the back of the empty restaurant. A week after she'd moved into the Fleabag Hotel, Romany Marie had seen the desperation in Clara's eyes as she sat at a table and offered her a waitress position. The restaurant had once been the artistic heart of the village, but these days few folks came by. Those who did knew that Romany Marie would let them gorge themselves on free rolls and all the coffee they could drink. She clanked around the small restaurant with her jangly necklaces and full skirts, and confided to Clara that she came from Red Hook, not Romania. But she lent the place an air of mystique that other diners lacked. After an unseasonably warm couple of days that made winter seem far away, the temperature was supposed to plummet that evening. These days, cold weather was a threat, not a nuisance. The radiator in Clara's hotel room clanged constantly but emitted no heat, and a cold spell meant it would be impossible to paint, even if she wore fingerless gloves. Her waitressing shifts left her too exhausted to paint anyway. Really, there was no point. Closed galleries, slashed museum budgets. No one in their right mind would waste money buying a painting these days. Artists were at the bottom of the food chain. They had nothing of value to offer. They didn't bake bread or knit scarves. They put liquid on paper and watched it dry. That was it. But guardian angels were out there, if you looked hard enough. Like Romany Marie, who frequently ushered pale, trembling artists into her back office, men who had been heralded 12 months earlier, and bought a work or two off them. The reverberations from her father's fall from grace had stayed with Clara throughout the heady days of success, prompting her to sock away everything she could. But nothing could have prepared her for the futility of the times. The highest-paid woman artist in America? What a joke! She looked up to see a blurry figure at the door. A man swept in as if on a tidal wave. Levon. She ran to the kitchen, told Romany Marie she wasn't feeling well, and hid behind a column where Levon couldn't see her, peeking out to watch their exchange. He wore the finely cut jacket that had replaced his ratty wool one soon after he began to sell, and raindrops tipped off a sleek black fedora. In his stylish ensemble,
She could have sketched him into one of her editorial illustrations back in the day, accompanied by a woman holding the leash of a slick greyhound. She didn't want him to see her like this. Sallow, skinnier than ever, miserable. Romany Marie breezed by and shot her a quizzical look. "You go take care of him now. He asked for you."
Clara inched over like a child about to be punished. He looked up and bellowed, "Clara!" before wrapping his arms around her and lifting her off her feet.
"Nothing's changed, I see." She pulled away and wiped the rain off her sleeves. "You're a beast still."
"I am a beast, but a hungry one."
Up close, she could see his cheeks were gaunt, his old ruddiness now a pallor. No doubt a stick figure lurked beneath his beautifully cut suit. His fine clothes had distracted her from the truth. And here she was, hiding from him.
"What can I get you? Did you give your order already?"
"Just some hot water is fine."
She knew what he meant. The other artists did the same. Order hot water, then add to it whatever was on the table, ketchup, salt, pepper, to make a thin soup.
"No, you need something more substantial."
"Really, hot water will do. I don't have anything."
The last sentence came out in a whisper. She retreated into the kitchen and pulled a big chunk of cheddar out of the icebox and a roll from the basket. "For a dear friend," she said to Romany Marie. "You can take it out of my pay."
Romany Marie shrugged her off.
Clara sat down with two cups of coffee and pushed one over to him. "It'll warm you up." He took a few sips before picking up the cheese. The whole time, his left hand stayed in his lap.
"What's wrong?"
She indicated his arm.
"Lead poisoning. Them pencils."
A memory of Levon gripping a thick chunk of pencil lead in his fist popped into her head, the pad of his hand as gray as an angry ocean. He'd light a cigarette and take a smoke break without washing it off, practically ingesting the poison. For a fastidious man, such carelessness.
"I'm sorry. How are you doing?
What do you do now?" "No shows, of course. I teach some private lessons, mainly society ladies who feel sorry for me. I can't paint again until the numbness goes away."
"When does your doctor think that'll happen?"
"Soon, I hope."
He lowered his voice.
"I am sorry about what I did. In Maine. That Oliver left you because of my silliness."
His silliness and her own stupidity. She'd been greedy, wanting both Levon and Oliver to herself. Her arrogance had rivaled Levon's, and in the end, he'd found her disappointing. Which served her right. Even in the darkness, she'd caught the look of distaste on his face after they'd pulled away from each other. How long ago it seemed.
"Don't be sorry. Oliver didn't even give me a chance to explain. I hear he's out in California now with that actress girl."
"I ruined it for you, and you miss him. I can tell."
Levon wiped his mustache.
"Not that, exactly. But it's hard.
Hard to be alone. Hard without anyone else to share the burden of not knowing what was to come."
"What do you do?"
Levon asked.
"Besides this?"
He gestured around the empty restaurant.
"Do you paint?"
She shivered involuntarily. "No, it's too cold in my room."
"Even Fifth Avenue landlords are being stingy."
"I'm not living there anymore. I had to move out."
"Where, then?"
"The Hotel 17. He took her hand.
"You're freezing, even here. Come with me. We must warm you up."
After checking in with Romany Marie, she left with Levon. His studio was exactly as she remembered it, immaculate and ordered, except for a bowl of fruit rotting on a table. A blackened banana had caved in on itself, and three apples were patchy with mold. Fruit flies fluttered about, and a sickly scent permeated the entire room.
How can you stand it?
She held her nose while he picked up the bowl of fruit and dumped it out a window.
Are you in a memento mori phase these days? I can't blame you.
But when she saw the canvas on his easel, she regretted her flippant response. Levon had attempted to draw the fruit when fresh, but the lines were shaky, feeble. He'd abandoned the drawing halfway through, and knowing him, refused to throw out the fruit as a fetid punishment for his ineptitude. Levon put some wood on the fire and sat Clara in the armchair in front of it, draping several blankets over her.
Coffee?
He held up a familiar blue and gold can. You have Martinsons?
Of course. I don't skimp when it comes to my coffee. Only the best. I have to keep up appearances.
You do a good job of it. I was sure you were a wealthy man when you walked into the restaurant. How do you manage?
My private classes. My society ladies treat me like a pet. They bring me cans of coffee and their husbands' old hats, bestow gifts on me for my services.
Your services?
An introduction to the world of beauty. They are my patrons, and I grovel accordingly.
She studied him as he made the coffee, tried to keep her tone light.
Why do I suspect the lessons involve a serious examination of anatomy?
He shrugged, but didn't answer her question.
How thrilled the ladies must be to have a distinguished painter visit them in their parlors and provide attention that their distracted husbands cannot.
She checked herself, her sarcasm unwarranted.
You've kept the studio, though. Must be worth it for that alone.
True. My services are much appreciated.
She could have sworn that was a smirk on his face. Clara pushed off the suffocating blankets.
Lucky you, remaining solvent by being able to charm old ladies.
She hit the word charm hard. He leaned against the table, waiting for his fancy coffee to brew.
You're angry with me for that?
Only because I don't have the chance. If the situation were reversed, and I was asked by the idle rich man of New York to tutor them in the painterly arts, I could never boast of it. I would be considered a disgrace, a prostitute, whoring myself out. Yet you get to indulge in the same behavior and strut about like a rooster with no repercussions.
A look of shock crossed his face at her crassness.
These women, they are sad. They are devastated and unsure, just like you.
Does that mean you're going to mess about with me, too?
She glared at him. Don't even think about it. Levon poured the coffee into two chipped, mismatched cups, set them on the small table beside her, and knelt down.
Don't be angry, Clara.
Her anger came from all sides. From Mr. Bianchi's words, which still smarted, from Oliver leaving her to flounder, from the fact that she had had so much and squandered it all. He took her hands in his.
You must live here, with me, from now on. I'll keep you warm.
She'd done everything she could to push him away. Her eyes burned with tears.
I have nothing to offer you.
I have nothing either. But I've already lived through this kind of hunger, day in and day out. We sucked on stones. We ate grass, anything to fill that void, even if nothing would come of it. But there are other ways to fill the void. With painting, with art. I'll show you.
How to suck on stones?
No. You don't understand.
I do, Levon.
Her tone softened. I do understand.
She studied the artworks against the side wall, where he stored his best. Where's the painting of your mother?
It's in the bedroom. Turn to the wall. I can't bear to look at it if I can't work on it.
He looked like he was about to cry, his eyes big and round, like the boy's in the portrait with his mother. Clara's petty resentments subsided. I shouldn't judge you on your students, your arrangements. She kicked off one shoe and rubbed the arch of her foot, wondering what to say next. She'd never been at a loss for words with him before, and their friendship would never be the same if she didn't address what happened in Maine. Best to get straight to the point. The night on the beach. I'm sorry about that.
About what?
Disappointing you.
Yes, I was disappointed.
His forcefulness made her heart sink.
With myself, for having stepped over the lines of friendship. I couldn't help myself, though, and I don't regret it. Well, yes, I regret not chasing after you, telling you to stay with me, not Oliver.
They sat in silence for several moments. She could hear her heart beating. I'd like to paint you, Levon. He stared hard at her, a challenge, but she knew he'd give in. He rose and gestured to the art supplies on the work table.
Help yourself. Might as well get some use out of them. Where do you want me?
Sit on the model's stand, with your arms on your knees. He did so. The white of his shirt accentuated his darkness. Olive skin, black hair falling over his forehead, the thick mustache above his lips. He gazed across the room at the rain falling outside, lost in a reverie as she worked. Satisfied with the sketch, she squeezed lines of paint onto the palette, mixed and remixed them, before dipping her brush and applying paint to canvas. She worked fast, knowing that he wouldn't sit for her again. This was her one chance. Later, as the paint dried, they made love on the pile of blankets in front of the fire. A chaotic feast of long limbs, bony elbows, and hunger. The next couple of months flew by. The painting Clara had made of Levon that first evening was stored in the tiny bedroom, as neither of them wanted any of their friends to see it. It was too personal, a window into their shared pain and pleasure. They satisfied their desires as often as they could as the weather grew cold, as if the friction of their bodies might stave off the harsh winter ahead. Whenever Romany Marie had leftover food, she'd give it to Clara to take home, and she and Levon invited all the artists they knew over for dinner. Clara provided the household with food and cash, while Levon offered shelter and paint supplies. She harangued him when he insisted on the best, Lefebvre paints and Winsor & Newton brushes. At least once a week he came home with an art book tucked under his arm, an extravagance they could not afford, including a rare edition on Bruegel, which she threatened to toss out the window but surreptitiously curled up with in front of the fire whenever she knew he'd be out for the afternoon. The only other fights were over his meticulous management of his art supplies. She was used to the chaotic splatter of watercolors, of the mess of paint on her work clothes. He put up with that, flinching whenever a drop of paint fell on the floor, but insisted she place each brush back in the correct pottery vase along the window sill when finished, arranged by size, the bristles clean and dry. When he was called for a lesson uptown, they didn't speak of it. He wandered off, and she didn't question him when he returned looking rumpled and abashed. Sometimes he had to give a lesson in the studio, and she'd return to find her painting of him turned to the wall, the covers of their bed pulled up tight, even though they never bothered to make it otherwise. Or she'd come home to him with his shirt off, violently scrubbing the studio floor, the easels and chairs and tables pushed to one side, as if he was trying to erase all signs that another woman even walked upon the parquet. A small price to pay, she told herself. She continued painting, Levon strolling behind her every so often with encouragement or a suggestion, miming with his hand the correct brush stroke to use. Some days it was as if she were channeling him, channeling their energy together. She painted whenever she could, making up for his own lost time in a way, never knowing how long their luck would last, how long they'd be able to hold out here without the landlord raising the rent and sending them packing. Her work was more dreamlike than anything she'd done before, save the siren. She was determined to push herself as far from illustration, from realism, as she could go. On Christmas Eve, they invited several friends over. The celebration would be lackluster compared to years past, the china mismatched and the linens frayed, but at least it was something. A sense of humility permeated the discussions these days, as the economic devastation had leveled the field. Salacious topics, artist affairs, gallery scandals, were replaced with more elevated discussions on politics and art. Levon no longer spoke over everyone else with his commandments and pronouncements. Nor did anyone else, for that matter. Romany Marie had offered 2 roasted ducks for their Christmas Eve celebration. Levon balanced them in his arms, while Clara fiddled with the lock to the studio.
Hurry up, woman.
I am. It's not working. No, it's unlocked. She pushed open the door. You've got to remember to lock it. What if someone came up here and stole everything?
Like what?
Your fancy art books. To burn in a fire to keep warm, you'd be upset.
Now, now, children.
Felix stood on the far side of the room. He shrugged.
It was unlocked.
You're an hour early. Clara walked over to give him a kiss.
You both seem well. As well as we can be.
Levon set down the ducks before pouring them all a drink from the bottle of wine he'd received from one of his Park Avenue students.
Any good news on the horizon?
Felix wandered about the room, his eyes darting from canvas to canvas. Clara had planned on hiding the paintings away before anyone arrived.
The government is considering financing a program where artists get paid to work, to paint murals for new buildings, build sculpture for public spaces, that kind of thing.
How much would they pay? She asked, trying to divert his attention.
Who knows? It's a long way off. Artists are low on the list of people to be propped up these days.
She put the drink in Felix's hand. Here, come sit by the fire. He dropped heavily into the chair and raised his glass.
I have good news for you, Levon.
What's that?
I'm glad I came early, before you cleared the room. They're glorious. I can find a buyer for these. Even in this market, this is phenomenal. The Museum of Modern Art will want to see them. You've made great strides.
Clara froze. Levon took a sip of his wine and responded coolly.
Do you think so?
Absolutely.
What do you like about them? Why do you like them?
How do I sum it up? They're glorious, free, and yet they show so much pain. It hurts to look at them, but I couldn't stop. I can't stop.
He leaned forward.
Your arm must be much improved. Thank God for that.
They're not mine. They're Clara's.
No. Felix blinked. He looked at Clara, then back to Levon.
Yes? They're all hers. I can't paint yet. Soon, but not yet.
He held up his bad arm, letting it tremble. Felix sat back in his chair, contemplating the news.
That's a shame.
What's a shame? Clara wiped off her hands on a dish rag and joined them, leaning against the mantle above the fire. You say they're good. They can be sold.
Not until the Depression's over. Your timing is off. Heck, even if you were a man, the fact that you're known for drawing clothes and cars makes it an unlikely leap.
Lavon stood.
It's the art that matters, not the person who made it.
Clara held out her hand to calm him down, but he shook her off.
We've been talking for months now about the purity of art. How this Depression has rid us of our commercial obsessions. Her work is as pure as it gets.
I agree. It's not fair, but in this climate, no gallery would take a chance on a woman illustrator these days.
Felix turned a skeptical eye on Clara.
Even if she were as good as Picasso.
Chapter 20. December 1930. The party dragged on well into the next morning. No one had anywhere else to go or anything else to do. Christmas was sure to be dismal compared to holidays past, so what was the point of rushing home? Lavon drank more than usual and jumped up several times to perform Armenian dances. To the cheers of their guests, he lumbered about the room, caterwauling at the top of his lungs, crashing into the table and sending glassware flying. Clara didn't bother to hide her petulance from her place in the corner, where she sat on a pillow on the floor. Every so often, Lavon looked at her with his big brown eyes, lips in a pout, trying to rouse her spirits. But she refused to engage. Not that anyone else noticed. Their guests were drinking heavily. The more successful artists in chairs, with various girlfriends and former students, sprawled about on the floor around them. Again, the men in thrones simply because they were men. They had access to the best galleries and patrons, and because of that, they became better known, and because of that, they were rewarded with success. It wasn't fair. And not exactly true. Other women had done well. Georgia O'Keeffe, of course, and Mary Cassatt. Even Clara had experienced a blazing, if temporary, success. One of the artists had brought his small dog along, a stocky terrier who curled up on Clara's lap. She ran a hand down his spine. The dog looked up at her with soft eyes, then he was out again, snoring softly. He wore a thin leather collar flaked with age. No tag. She wondered what he was called. When the crowd began to dissipate, she lifted him off her lap and placed him in the warm chair where Lavon had been. That odd dog in Maine, Clyde, came to mind. Clyde. The name she'd used for the siren after Oliver's peevish criticism. Buzzing with excitement, Clara herded out the last of the stragglers, holding Felix back with another pour of wine. His face was flushed. Even better to break through his defenses. Convince him.
We can show the work. My work.
She stood, her feet slightly apart, in the middle of the studio. Lavon cleared up a broken glass beside the sink, and Felix slumped at the table, hat in one hand and wine in the other.
How is that, my dear?
Felix exchanged a tired glance with Lavon.
You say that it's by an unknown painter, one you've just discovered, named Clyde. I sign all the paintings with that. You explain that the painter wishes to stay unknown.
Unknown? Why on earth?
Lavon laughed at her. Of course he couldn't imagine staying anonymous. His big presence was part of his art. But hers was not.
Why not? You said they're good. Everyone will assume they're by a man. They can be judged on what they are, not who I am, or am not.
Felix shook his head. It's not a parlor trick.
exhibiting paintings. Maybe it should be.
Levon dropped the shards of glass into the trash. They tinkled like wind chimes.
Why not? What do you have to lose, Felix?
Felix set down his glass.
Do you have any idea how much money it takes to put on a show? You artists, you all think it's a matter of hanging paintings on a wall and waiting for the crowds to come.
He counted off on his fingers.
I must find a suitable space, arrange to have all the paintings framed, solicit potential buyers in a discreet yet unyielding manner. There's a kind of magic required, an expensive magic. I can't take that chance if I can't guarantee sales.
She stood her ground. We know you can do it. You're the best, Felix, and you love the work. Shouldn't it come down to that? The work will sell. You'll be hailed as the man of the hour.
Stop flattering me. If it's about the economics, I can help.
Levon stepped closer. Together, the two of them were circling in on Felix.
I'll pay for the framing.
How? How will you do that? Clara asked, dreading the answer.
I'll take up more private lessons. No, you don't have to do that.
Felix took off his glasses and cleaned them with the edge of a napkin.
If you can pay for the framing, we might be able to pull it off. We'll do it. Don't worry,
Levon insisted.
I'm not promising anything.
Felix stood and pulled his coat off the coat rack by the door.
And I'm drunk, so don't count on it, either of you. Stop ganging up on me.
Clara gave him a kiss before he headed out into the early morning. Thank you, Felix.
Clyde. Insane. Both of you. All three of you.
And he was gone. Where are you going now? And what's in the satchel? Clara didn't mean to sound like a harpy, but she'd been painting for 2 months straight, ever since they'd hatched the Clyde show idea, and had serious cabin fever. Felix had arranged for an exhibit to take place next month, early April, when he hoped the change of weather from winter to spring would encourage art lovers to open their wallets. She'd let Levon and Felix handle all the details. Clara didn't care where or when the show would happen, because the pressure to create enough paintings to fill the room was enough to deal with. Some days she didn't venture outside at all. Levon gave her a quick kiss.
I'm heading uptown. Do you need anything? More supplies?
The man was adept at changing the subject when it came to his mysterious errands. But she knew what he was up to. Raising money from his Park Avenue ladies to help get the exhibit mounted, to get enough cash to pay for frames. Earlier that morning, she'd spied a note on the dresser signed Nadine, which had turned her stomach. Sharing him with anonymous old biddies was one thing, but a mutual acquaintance, especially that wretched girl, was quite another. Not that Clara had said anything, knowing she should shut up and be grateful for his efforts on her behalf. He'd even begun filching from his own bookcase when he thought Clara wasn't looking. The strap of the satchel strained against his shoulder.
"Please stop selling your art books," she implored, not for the first time. The books were like his children, each one precious. You don't have to do that. We'll find another way.
He patted the side of the bag.
Never you mind. Besides, once the show's a great success, I'll buy them all back first thing.
Any talk of the show made her squirm with irritation.
When you return, I want you to paint as well, she said.
Levon's doctor had declared his symptoms much improved on his last visit, yet he'd resisted Clara's entreaties to pick up a brush. The more he resisted, the more she pushed him, partly to offset her own nerves and also because she feared the longer he put it off, the harder it would be to find his footing.
Stop with that, woman,
Levon waved her away. Concentrate on your own work.
But what about you?
I'm fine.
Then paint with me.
He let the satchel fall hard to the floor. You want to see me paint? He was beside her in a flash and snatched the brush from her hand with his left hand. I tried it the other morning, when you were still asleep.
He held the brush clumsily in his dominant hand.